Welcome back to Issues, Etc. 55 minutes of open lines ahead for your questions and your comments. Now, somewhere in here, we're going to hear from Dr. Thomas Oden as well, get his reaction to the goings-on in Washington State. You heard the story. It's been all over the papers. I think it even made the front page of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. An openly lesbian minister in the United Methodist Church. There's strike one, because at least according to the Book of Order, the United Methodist Church is not supposed to ordain or have serving as ministers openly gay people. She came out about 3 years ago to her bishop. No real consequences there. Last week before last, March 11th, I believe it was, she got married to her longtime lesbian partner. The trial ensues, of course. It was already underway before that. She was exonerated this weekend. She will, at least if plans go as they are, be reinstated to her church as a pastor in the United Methodist Church. We'll find out what Thomas Oden has to say about that a little bit later. The question for you, what film should Gibson make next now that he's made The Passion of the Christ? Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. There was something else I was supposed to do here, but I've forgotten what it is, so let's go to the phones. Pat's calling from her car. Pat, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi.
Hi, Pat.
Hey, what do you think about The Life of Joseph?
Now, that's a brilliant suggestion, because it's ready-made.
Right, you got the whole dysfunctional family thing in there.
Yeah, you sure do.
Then you can bring it full circle with the whole forgiveness issue and everything.
And somebody's got to answer Andrew Lloyd Webber's Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat. Someone's got to answer that, because that is that's the way most people came to know the story of Joseph.
Right.
Thank you very much, Pat. That's a great suggestion. There's Bible scholars look at the book of Genesis, and they break it into basically two parts: prehistory and Abraham and his legacy there, and then what they call the Joseph novella, the little novel of Joseph, which leads us into the book of Exodus. There's more ink spread on the pages about Joseph in the book of Genesis than any other single character. It's the setup story, of course, for the Exodus, but it's an amazing story in and of itself. It's a good suggestion. Mary's calling from her car. Mary, thank you for being patient, and welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello?
Hi, Mary.
Hi. I was thinking about Paul.
What, a movie about Paul?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we had somebody in the last segment call about that and suggest that. What do you think would be most compelling there as far as a movie? Why would you go see a movie like that?
Well, I mean, myself, the way he was before he was converted and after his conversion, what he did.
Mary, thank you very much. I said before, you do have that character arc there with Paul. There is a problem, though. I mean, it's got great stuff. It's got shipwrecks, prison, imprisonment. He gets bit by snakes. I mean, it's just action-packed. There'd be a danger of either making him into an action hero. If an evangelical made the film, they'd make him into an action hero. They'd have him with the rippling stomach muscles and the, you know, bared chest half the time, you know, fighting off not just a snake, but the huge, like, 12-foot anaconda, but nearly trying to kill him. You know, they'd have the shipwreck take place at unbelievably high seas like you get in the northern Atlantic, not the kind of storms they have in the Mediterranean. Paul is no action hero. As I said before, after Jesus stops him on the road to Damascus, his life pretty much goes from bad to worse. Very steadily downhill, and it ends with, if we're to believe the tradition, off with his head at the end of a Roman sword. There's a problem where you conclude that. Wouldn't that be a great ending to a movie, though? The great ending to the movie would be, that's how I did the Paul movie. I mean, I'm trying to think like an amateur filmmaker. I'd begin it with basically the Damascus Road. I would end it with Paul at the wrong end of the Roman sword. And I wouldn't show the beheading. I'd just show Paul's head on the block. You know, his eyes looking into the camera. And then I'd end the film, just literally end the film and go to the credits with the sound of the sword coming down. You'd go straight to a black screen. Be a great ending to a film. Oh, if I had the money or someone to bankroll this thing. 505-750-1800-730-2727. Jim is calling from St. Charles. Jim, welcome to Issues Etc.
Yes. I've got one going forward a little bit, and that is a little bit beyond the Bible to what happened to the Christians after that and how they suffered in by the Roman Empire and had to stay in catacombs and all that, and yet were victorious over it, even though they were killed by the gladiators. I call it a slice, three slices of history. Then go to the Dark Ages and see how sometimes the church persecuted people who didn't agree with them, and along came Luther, and we had, from the Dark Ages, we had to an Age of Enlightenment. And then slip over from leaving Europe to the United States and beginning there with to see the hard things like that happened on the Mayflower, half of them died, and then later on how they got away from their main thing, and then revivals took place in America. And it may work some American people up in the United States to say, hey, we need a little taste of that today.
Jim, thank you for the call. The only downside to that, I mean, well, there are two downsides. One, the whole scope of the, of that film is gigantic. It'd be kind of like Mel Brooks doing The History of the World Part 2. But the other thing is, it gives the impression that Christianity somehow has found its new home in America. You know, if you're going to tell the story of persecution, you could not only tell it about the first several centuries after Christ's death, resurrection, and ascension, you could tell it up to the present day. For heaven's sakes, more Christians have died under the weighty hand of persecution in the 20th century than in all the previous centuries combined. I mean, if you count what Stalin did, and if you count the persecution that continues unabated in much of Africa. What about the rest of you? Mel Gibson makes another film. What in the world does he, what film does he make? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Now, someone called earlier suggesting a movie about the first three chapters, The Creation and the Fall. Now, where you end that film is key. If you ended at 3:15 with the promise of the Christ, the seed that would come from Mary that would contend with this with Satan and eventually overcome him, that's a good place to end that film. I mean, talk about a special effects spectacular. How would you do the creation of the universe? I mean, almost, I don't see how you could possibly, I used to think this about the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I remember reading these novels over and over again as a teenager, then into my young adulthood, just reading them over and over again. I'm not exaggerating. I think in the case of at least the first and the second, I always got a little bogged down with the Return of the King, but maybe a dozen times. Just when I finished the trilogy, I start right over again. Thinking, man, wouldn't this make a great movie? But then I think to myself, you could never do it. You could never do it. Well, along comes Jackson. He does it. And he does it far in excess of anyone's expectations. You think about a creation film. How would you do this? Maybe it can be done. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. These universalist Unitarian ministers, here's an interesting question, a very interesting question. This happened last week. These two ministers, now you remember in Paltz County, when the county officials there said, we're going to start issuing marriage licenses, we're going to start letting gay people get married in Paltz County, New York, New Paltz, I guess it is. Well, two Unitarian Universalist ministers took up the call. And within their churches, they decided they would do some marrying of gay couples. Now, albeit without licenses. The story from Kingston, New York, according to the Associated Press, a New York prosecutor charged two Unitarian Universalist ministers with marrying 13 same-sex couples without a license. Today, they're being arraigned, by the way. Kay Greenleaf admits to performing ceremonies in New Paltz while knowing that the couples didn't have licenses. She said she considered the unions to be civil. Don Sangre, or Sangre, is also charged. But Ulster County District Attorney Donald Williams says he decided to press charges because the ceremonies were, quote, drastically different from religious ceremonies. It's believed to be the first time that clergy have been prosecuted in the gay marriage debate. I remember hearing this story on the radio when I was driving around. And I thought to myself, now here's one that has all the potential to come back and bite us in the backside. Do we want any ministers performing gay marriages without licenses? No. Do we want them charged for doing these things in their churches by civil authorities? If they can charge you for doing them, can they charge you for not doing them? Depending on what the law says. Now, let's hear from Robert Gottlieb. He's an attorney for the ministers who says that the prosecution of his clients is simply a disgrace.
The decision to criminally prosecute members of the clergy is just terribly misguided. It's shameful, and it reflects an abuse of our criminal justice system.
Now, I'm hearing this attorney thinking to myself, there's that little thing inside me that says to prosecute any ministers, even the Unitarian Universalist, for the ceremonies they perform within their church is a disgrace. Now, Gottlieb went on to say that District Attorney Donald Williams there in New Paltz claims that he had no choice but to charge the ministers, although he has declined to prosecute others for other crimes.
It's a misdemeanor, just as this crime that they're charged with is a misdemeanor. And I said to Mr. Williams, how many politicians, Mr. Williams, do you know who've committed the crime of adultery? Nobody expects you to prosecute it because you have the discretion to say it doesn't belong in criminal court.
So where do you fall on this? He says, look, there are other things that are on the books that are illegal that they don't prosecute because not only are they misdemeanors, but they're considered to be, well, in all practical terms, unprosecutable. If adultery is a crime in a state, which it may still be in some states, it's not prosecuted. Why? Well, the prisons would be full, or at the very least, our courts would be bogged down with such charges. District attorneys do decide what they're going to prosecute and not prosecute. But I want to know where you fall on this. Do we want the state prosecuting ministers? I won't call these Christian ministers because Unitarian Universalists would not take kindly to me calling them Christians. But ministers of any religion for ceremonies that they perform in their church. Let's start taking calls on this question right now. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's still open lines, issues, etc. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. On the one hand, you don't want these ministers to go around performing marriage ceremonies even when they call them civil unions. Marriage ceremonies without a license. On the other hand, do you want the civil authority stepping in and saying you can't perform any ceremony in your church? They did gay marriages, 13 of them. They knew there were no licenses. They knew that these were not valid marriages. They did them anyway. They've been arraigned today in New Paltz County. What do you think? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. This comes from CBS News, the latest from CBS News on this story. In a case reflecting how controversial the issue of same-sex marriage overlaps church and state, two New York state ministers were to be arraigned Monday on misdemeanor charges for marrying same-sex couples. The Reverends Greenleaf and Sangre, both Unitarian Universalist Church of New Paltz in New York, say that they will not plead guilty, and they are ready to take the case to court. They're accused of performing marriages of same-sex couples who lacked a civil marriage license. It's the same charge that's... Now, here's another little monkey wrench in the works. It's the same charge that was leveled against the New Paltz mayor, Jason West, after he married 25 gay and lesbian couples last month. Same charge. Now, you're the district attorney. You got a mayor in violation of his civil oath marrying gay couples. He's charged with doing this without valid licenses. Now, the Unitarian Universalist ministers, they do it too in their church. No licenses. Same circumstances. And under New York law, they marry as, not as religious officials, but as civil servants. In the case of marriage, this is the way it is in many states in the United States. When it comes to the performance of a marriage ceremony, pastors, strictly speaking, in a legal sense, are not acting as religious ministers. They are solemnizing these marriages as those who have been granted the state's authority to put their signature on a marriage license saying, it's done. Vows taken, marriage done. These people are man and wife in the eyes of the law. Does it make a difference whether it's the mayor who does it or a minister who does it? The district attorney in New Paltz, New York says, no. He's going to charge everybody who does it, or at least everybody he finds who does this. The New Paltz cases are a one corner of a nationwide fight between advocates for same-sex marriage pushing to conduct such ceremonies and opponents working to ban them. The controversy erupted over the highest court in Massachusetts when it ruled that the state's ban on same-sex marriages was unconstitutional, opening the way for gay and lesbian weddings in May. Now, this may still happen first week in May. San Francisco's mayor soon opened the city hall there in that city to same-sex couples wishing to wed, and thousands, of course, did. President Bush then called for a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage. If you're going to charge the mayor in New Paltz, shouldn't you also charge the ministers in New Paltz when they commit exactly the same crime? What do you think about this? And I ask again, if you can be charged for doing something like this in violation of the law, what if the law reads differently? Can you be charged for not doing it? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, this is also tied up with the case. Well, it's not tied up. It's associated in the CBS News story with the case of the Reverend Damon out in Washington State, an avowedly lesbian in a long-term relationship who, as a matter of coincidence, also happened to get married. I think it was in Portland, if I'm not mistaken. She traveled to Multnomah County. She got married there to her lesbian. And this was all in the light of a pending church trial. Now, I'm looking here at these cases, and I'm thinking to myself, it's one thing for the United Methodist to say, we have a book of order, you violated it. By the way, they didn't do that. The United Methodist clergy there who held her church trial, who presided at her church trial, looked at the United Methodist book of order, read what it said, denied what it said, ignored what it said, and said, you're still a pastor in our church. But it's one thing for a church to say you violated our rules of conduct, whatever they may be. It's an entirely different thing, or so it seems to me, for the civil authorities to step in and say, now, when you married a gay couple, you shouldn't have done that. Does it make a difference if it's the mayor of New Paltz or ministers in New Paltz who do this? When you applauded that the mayor of New Paltz, I know many of you did, last week, week before last, when the mayor of New Paltz, New York, said, I'm going to marry gay couples, and he married 25 of them, and he was charged by the district attorney, you said, good, that's what should happen to all these guys. Well, then a minister does it, and they get charged too. What does it say about the current state of American religion that the state has to execute discipline for the church? Not that the Unitarian Universalists are going to discipline anybody, unless, of course, you mention God, then you can get in trouble. But remember the little flap they had this winter over one of their officials who wanted to just put a passing reference to a generic God in some of their statements? They said no. It kind of undoes what it means to be a Unitarian Universalist. And you know what? They were right. they're wrong in denying God, but they were right in at least being consistent with their beliefs, whatever those may be. Do you expect civil authorities to do this, to carry out discipline within the church? Had it been against the law in Washington State for the Reverend Damon to marry her lesbian partner, would you have expected her to be charged by the civil authorities for doing this? The church authorities aren't going to lift a finger to do anything about it. Or, like it or not, is this an example of a place where the civil authority should not tread? As much as we don't want to see gay marriages carried out within the walls of any church, the civil authorities should keep their hands off of the ministers who do it. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines this Monday, March the 22nd. Now, I had some thoughts on this weekend. I was mulling it over that I'm driving out to an invitation to preach in Strasburg, Illinois. Very, very nice congregation out there, by the way. Right on the very edge of our listening area. Pastor Stephen Becker is their pastor. Great people. I'm driving out there, so I have 2.5 hours on Sunday morning before the sun comes up to think this over. I'm listening to the radio. They announced the decision of the church court out in Washington. And, of course, it does not come as a surprise to me. The best hopes, we talked with Mark Tooley last week. He said, you know, if they go by the church's book of order, they will not exonerate her. She will be defrocked. He said they probably won't defrock her. They'll just slap her wrist but not defrock her. They didn't even slap her wrist. They said there was no evidence to find, even though she is openly gay, even though she did marry in violation of the church's book of order, she is a minister in their church in violation of the church's book of order. They said, no evidence. No evidence. And I'm thinking to myself, how many other church bodies are on precisely the same path? We have, don't we, something like an don't ask, don't tell, don't pursue policy when it comes to this? Yeah, you'll hear your pastor mention gay marriage in the sermon as one of those societal ills that we all got to live with nowadays. Almost as though it's kind of the same thing as poverty and homelessness and drug abuse and Hollywood's rotten influence. One of those things that's out there, not in here. But when it comes to actually dealing with what people believe about this, it's don't ask. It's don't tell. It's don't pursue the subject. Don't ask any questions. Let's say this to the pastors who are listening, and I know that many do. If you want your church to go the way of the United Methodist Church, or for that matter, the Episcopal Church USA or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, all three of whom in their own ways have approved of openly lesbian or gay ministers, don't ask any questions. Don't ask your people what they believe. Don't pursue this subject. We'll be right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Perhaps St. Peter is best known for his greatest sin, denying Jesus Christ 3 times. But the story of St. Peter is really the story of God's grace in Jesus Christ. It's really the story of every Christian. Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for March is called Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net. It's the story of God's grace shown to St. Peter in Jesus Christ our Savior. This children's book is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order it by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section. It's our book of the month for March. Follow me, Peter Lays Down His Net. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. A Democrat and a Republican in the Senate are teaming up to require federal funding for abortions on military bases if the woman has been the victim of rape or incest. Keith Peters has the story from Washington.
Democrat Barbara Boxer of California and Republican Olympia Snow of Maine say the bill removes a barrier prohibiting the Defense Department from providing what they call critical reproductive health services for our troops. Right now, an abortion must be paid for by the woman herself. But Wendy Wright of Concerned Women for America says passing legislation like this would be just compounding the problem.
Contrary to that, according to studies done on women who had been raped and then had an abortion, they found that it was about like being victimized a second time, and that they had to then deal with the trauma of the abortion on top of the trauma of the rape.
Wright says Senators Boxer and Snow have not done their homework.
They haven't looked into how harmful abortion can be to women, and that their legislation would actually be causing more harm to an already victimized woman.
Douglas Johnson, legislative director of National Right to Life, says this type of legislation has been tried before under a compromise bill.
The abortions would be funded in cases of rape and incest, but only if those assaults were reported to a law enforcement agency. And the pro-abortion congressman had no interest in that sort of thing, which, of course, would prevent abuse.
Pro-life groups say the alternative should be providing medical care for the victim and making sure the criminal responsible is brought to justice. For Family News in Focus, I'm Keith Peters in Washington.
Douglas Johnson thinks the proposal to allow abortions at military bases is being introduced now to deflect public attention from the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. That's legislation that recognizes two victims when a pregnant woman and her unborn baby are harmed in a crime. That bill is scheduled to be heard this week in the Senate. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
You've seen Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ, and you're wondering, what does this mean? You attend church regularly, but your pastor seldom teaches or preaches about the suffering, death, and resurrection of Jesus. This is Todd Wilkin, host of Issues, Etc., inviting you to visit a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod congregation this week. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, we preach Christ and Him crucified.
Issues, Etc. is partially underwritten by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of our Book of the Month for March, Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net. It's written by Issues, Etc. regular guest Pastor Eric Rotman. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org and click the What's New section or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. The book is Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net.
We're taking your questions and your comments, your phone calls on the Unitarian Universalist ministers that have been arraigned today in New Paltz County, New York, on the same charges that were leveled against the mayor there when he performed 25 same-sex marriages. The two Unitarian Universalist ministers also performed a number of marriages, 13, I think, between them. They're being arraigned on exactly the same charges. What do you think about it? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Has the state overstepped its bounds? Is what's good for the goose good for the gander when it comes to this, whether you're a mayor or a minister? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Kathy's calling from St. Charles. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Pastor. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think in these areas, these churches historically in the past have blurred distinctions between men and women, and then allowing women in the pastoral office or clergy, and then they blurred the distinctions between the roles of men and women and allowing, you know, non-practicing homosexual clergy. And I think it just carries over that their distinctions are so blurred that they no longer are the moral place where people look for these kinds of issues. They're looking now to the state to define the things that in past, historically, the church has stood up for. And I think it's just a sad state of our times. What do you think?
Kathy, thank you very much. Well, yes, I agree. There's nothing there that you have said that I disagree with. Slowly over time, some churches have gone a little faster, some have gone a little slower. But slowly over time, these mainline denominations like the Episcopal Church USA, the United Methodist Church, we could name others, the United Churches of Christ and the Presbyterian Church USA, and others, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the three that have actually decided that they're going to, in their own way, approve of same-sex clergy are the United Methodist Church, that happened this weekend, over against what they say. What they say their official teachings are make very little difference, folks. What they say their official teachings are make very little difference when they ignore those teachings. There's a lesson for every church body. You can say you believe anything. If you don't back it up with what you teach and preach and what you're willing to say no to, it doesn't make any difference what you say you believe. It makes no difference whatsoever. None. Period. If the practice is don't ask, don't tell, don't pursue, and if pastors individually are not willing to ask their people what they believe about this, and to correct their people when they believe out of line with God's word on this. The danger here, and I agree with what Kathy had to say, the danger here is that those of us who occupy different places in the church, like more conservative church bodies, mine for instance, say, well, you know, that happens to the Methodists, it happens to the Episcopalians, it happens to the Presbyterians, and yes, even to some Lutherans if you're in that big bad Lutheran synod, but not to us. Never to us. You see, we're clear on what we believe about this. And I ask, are you? Are you clear on what you, I know what the official position might be, but if your people don't believe it, and if you as a pastor are not courageous enough to pursue what it is your people do believe on these issues, what's going to stop our church body from following in the footsteps of those others? Nothing. Nothing. Oh, no, we're not blurring the distinction between male and female. You know what I discovered very recently of my own church body? You don't necessarily have to take the baby steps over the cliff. Sometimes you just jump over all at once. Sometimes you leapfrog the little questions and go straight to heresy. No one's exempt. It's one thing for a church body, a congregation, a pastor to say, this is what we believe on paper. That counts for nothing if it doesn't translate off of paper into the lives of people. And if we want to follow in the footsteps of the Methodists and the Episcopalians and the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America on this issue, then we will continue a don't ask, don't tell, don't pursue. I'm not talking about rooting out homosexuals in your congregation. We'd like to know where they are so we can call them to repent. I'm talking about asking what your average parishioner believes. I'll tell you one thing, and I'll speak again to the pastors here. You know what they're doing? They're humoring you. They're humoring you, pastor. You might occasionally mention gay marriage in the pulpit or in a Bible class. And you look out in the sea of faces and they noddingly approve, yes, I think that's a societal ill that I wish we didn't have to deal with that. And isn't it such a shame that our children have to grow up in such a world? Some agree, some don't, and they're humoring you. Now, if they're humoring you on that, what else are they humoring you on? And how would you know unless you ask them? We hear all the time about courageous leadership in the church. You know what real courageous leadership is? Pastors who are willing to preach the word in season and out of season, who are willing to take that word and use it as it's intended to be used. Training in righteousness, yes. Knowledge of salvation, of course. But also exhortation, rebuke, correction, reproof. That's courageous leadership. Dr. Thomas Oden joins us. He's professor of theology and ethics at Drew University. Now, he's author of several books, including The Rebirth of Orthodoxy. That's his latest. He's a board member for a renewal group in the United Methodist Church called the Confessing Movement. He joins us very kindly to talk about the acquittal of a Methodist pastor of violating the church law by living as an open lesbian. Dr. Oden, welcome back to Issues, etc.
Glad to be with you, Todd.
Your general reaction to the goings-on this weekend at the state of Washington?
What happened in Washington was a conspiracy of the religious left leadership against due process, against the legislative majority. That is, again and again, the General Conference has stated its view that no self-avowed practicing homosexual will be ordained or appointed. Those by large majority, 64-74%. Nonetheless, 13 people who are conference colleagues of Karen Dahman voted against church law in a mock trial based on a technicality. That there was no compelling evidence that she was that she had broken any church law or that she had done anything incompatible with Christian teaching. Really, the question is, Todd, is anything incompatible with Christian teaching according to these advocates? Would anything at all stand as compelling evidence to them? If, for example, you had a confessed rapist, just think of a confessed rapist who says, yes, I did this, and then the jury says, no, we have no compelling evidence of that. It's so absurd that it is incredible to think of what has happened to our church discipline, that we cannot even acknowledge what our legislative process has repeatedly said is our doctrine and our moral teaching.
Dr. Oden, I was wondering, and I do not mean this to sound facetious, but I was honestly wondering what book of discipline the jury of 13 were reading from when they came to their conclusions. I was reading through the jury's verdict that was published today, and they said at one point, we searched the discipline, making reference to the book of discipline, and did not find a declaration that, quote, the practice of homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching. I spent 5 minutes looking through the church book of discipline. I found two separate references where it does say
right.
that the practice of homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching.
Right. All you need to do is to go to any United Methodist discipline written in the last 30 years and go to the index and look under homosexuality, and you will find that phrase. There's no question about the legislative will of the United Methodist Church. What has been broken is the Pacific Northwest region of the United Methodist Church now is functionally in schism. It is schismatic. It has, in effect, separated itself from United Methodist discipline, from scriptural teaching, from the history of the Christian church and its moral teaching, and especially from Wesleyan teaching. All of this is schismatic. But what will not be reported by the press, probably, is that the schismatics are the radical religious left.
Now, I've got to ask you, I guess, at least generally, about the degree to which this affects your confidence that groups like the Confessing Movement, of which you are a board member, renewal groups within the United Methodist Church, your confidence in their ability to turn this erring church body, the United Methodist Church, around.
The church does not need to be turned around in terms of legislation. The legislation is clear. In other words, we support the present church law. We're not trying to change present church law. We're only hoping that in good conscience, ministers who have voluntarily agreed to live under church discipline do so. Nobody required them to become ordained ministers. They have decided voluntarily to become ordained ministers. Now, when only a few, and this is characteristically less than a quarter of the people in the United Methodist Church, only a small number insist that this is not church law, and they can't even read it in the discipline, then they have functionally separated themselves or become schismatic from the United Methodist Church. And I think the real question ahead, Todd, is how that schismatic status will be understood and expressed by the General Conference.
Now, the General Conference is slated to meet in Pittsburgh at the end of April through the beginning of May. What are your expectations?
My expectations are that, again, by a very large majority, there will be a vote that says self-avowed practicing homosexuals shall not be ordained or appointed, and that homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching. Each time that language has been tested over the last 20 to 30 years in various ways, it has been sustained by large majorities. In fact, increasing majorities. The majorities in the last 20 years have increased from 62% to 74%. And we expect that 74% to hold or maybe increase in this General Conference. What is happening here is a desperate move on the part of those who are advocating a disobedience to church law, using a mock trial based upon a technicality to appear to have changed church law when they really haven't. It's only the General Conference that makes church law.
Dr. Thomas Oden is our guest. We're getting his reaction to the acquittal of an openly gay lesbian pastor in the United Methodist Church took place this weekend in a church trial. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Calling from his car, Kurt is on the line. Kurt, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. My question is, if a United Methodist congregation, say in Indiana, were to say, this is it, you know, we can't believe this is happening within the United Methodist Church and these people are getting away with it, and they decide to leave. Does the national denomination own the property? So is it similar to the Episcopalians? So if that congregation, if they're disgusted and they went out of the United Methodist Church, do they leave without their property?
That's a good question, Kurt. Thank you very much. Dr. Oden?
Thank you, Kurt. Most church lawyers would say yes, that they must leave without their property. However, this is a bit of a complex issue because every local church has a trust clause that pledges that local church to United Methodist doctrine and discipline. Okay, you with me thus far?
Yeah.
In other words, you cannot be a United Methodist church unless you follow United Methodist doctrine and discipline. And in this case, the people that would be following United Methodist doctrine and discipline would be being asked to leave their property behind. So I think this is where property issues will be contested. They're going to be contested all over the country. The religious left leadership has gotten itself and gotten the whole church into an extremely expensive difficulty. And it's not going to go away. It will harm everyone concerned, and they will simply not win.
Dr. Oden, what is the technicality? You've mentioned several times in the course of our conversation that this was a mock trial, that she was acquitted on a technicality. What is that technicality, at least by the opinion of the 13-member jury that acquitted Karen Damon?
Well, the argument of the attorney of Karen Damon said that, just as you had said, that church law does not apply in her case, and that there is an exemption. The technicality really refers to the, at least in part, to the fact that some of the phrases are in the social principles of the United Methodist Church, which is in the discipline and generally has been enforced by the judicial council as a part of the discipline. Now, the technicality was that because one or two out of a dozen or so phrases concerning homosexuality were in the social principles, that they were not church law. So it's on the thinnest and most fragile basis that the case was argued with a court that was already decided with colleagues of hers that had already made their mind up. They had previously judged her innocent, even though she herself had said that she is a self-avowed practicing homosexual.
Is it telling to you that conspicuously omitted from the jury's opinion, and I don't know about the actual deliberations, but at least from the jury's opinion, any reference to what Holy Scripture has to say on this subject?
I was not in the trial. I could not speak about what actually happened in the trial. I understand that there were reporters at the trial who probably have some written record of what was said at the trial. I know that one of the bishops at the trial sought to argue on the basis of Scripture, but basically the answer is no, it's not being argued on the basis of Scripture. It's being argued on the basis of cultural accommodation.
Several places in the press, a representative for the 13-member jury who acquitted Karen Damon made reference to the fact that this was, quote, painful and prayerful, or elsewhere it was quoted as a long and painful struggle. Every time I read this, I wonder whether or not this is some kind of code language. Why is it painful if what she was doing is not in violation of church law? Why would they have to struggle with this issue if, at least in the opinion of the jury, she's so obviously innocent of violating the Book of Discipline?
I think the whole issue has been painful for all of us in the mainline denominations. Every one of the mainline denominations has been deeply pained by the simple fact that congregations and legislative bodies have not wished or agreed to concede homosexuality as a sexual pattern that is blessed by God and that is a godly mode of sexuality. That is what is at issue, and there are some people that refuse to accept that large majority that has repeatedly spoken by due process.
Is this, have you put your finger upon, do you think, not only the problem that persists within the United Methodist Church, that on paper and legislatively, they continue to speak rather unequivocally about issues like this, the moral issues such as homosexuality.
Right.
Whereas in practice, they ignore those statements and they continue to follow the culture's
lead. In practice, only in a few places. In other words, in most conferences of the United Methodist Church, Karen Damon would not be a United Methodist minister. She would have already long ago been dismissed from her appointment. But it just so happens that she has an appointment in the Pacific Northwest Conference, which is one of the most far-left conferences in the United Methodist Church. And they don't care whether they don't care about the language of legislative United Methodism. What they care about is their own ideological biases.
Are we going to witness something, of course, on a smaller scale or a different scale, of what happened this winter with the Episcopal Church USA when the larger church body as a whole decided to consecrate and eventually to install Gene Robinson as the first openly gay bishop there? The Episcopalians who dissented from that said, look, we're the ones who are holding fast to the church's teaching. It is the church body at large that has stepped away from the church's teaching. Will we watch the same kind of consequence take place?
Well, in the I think the same consequences will take place. In the Episcopal Church, though, the Anglican Communion worldwide, which is 70 million people, only 20 million or so, no, no, only 3 million or so are in the United are in the United States. Okay, so the United States is the only region in the Episcopal Church that has disposed with classical Christian teaching about the sanctity of marriage. So what the Anglican Communion is saying to the Episcopal Church in the United States is that they have functionally separated themselves, functionally become schismatic from the rest of the Anglican Communion.
And do you have a mechanism in the Episcopal Church, I mean, within the United Methodist Church, to make a similar kind of a statement?
I think we do, yes. And I think that may occur in the General Conference, where there will be found, possibly found, a way for the General Conference to state that its will, its legislative will, was blatantly ignored by a particular conference, and thereby that conference stands in a broken, a schismatic relationship with the whole church. It has, in effect, excommunicated itself.
Dr. Thomas Oden, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Glad to talk with you, Todd.
Dr. Thomas Oden is professor of theology and ethics at Drew University. He's authored several books, including his latest, The Rebirth of Orthodoxy. He's a board member for a renewal group within the United Methodist Church called the Confessing Movement. Now, tomorrow on the program, we'll also hear from the head of another renewal group in the United Methodist Church, Pastor James Heidinger, of Good News. He's quoted in the press in reaction to the acquittal of an openly gay pastor in the United Methodist Church. When we come back from this break, an hour spent with Pastor John Pless. Pastor Pless has been looking at Rick Warren's best-selling book, often used book, The Purpose-Driven Life. We've talked about this on a number of occasions. Well, Pastor Pless has looked at it, and he said, look, if you're going to try and use this and take out those parts that are incompatible with Scripture, and there are parts there, we'll find out what they are on the other side of the break. He's not sure you could still use the book when you're done taking out those parts. What you salvage from The Purpose-Driven Life might not be seaworthy. He says, well, trying to take this book and take out the unscriptural parts and expecting it still to be useful to a Christian congregation is a little bit like taking the engine out of a car and expecting it to run. We'll find out why he says that about The Purpose-Driven Life when we come back. Pastor John Pless will be our guest.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.